The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
What songs should we sing in church? And then we're joined by Tim Glenn from Compassion International. You're listening to The Common Good. Happy Thursday, friends. Welcome to The Common Good here on AM 1160, Hope for Your Life. My name is Brian Fromm. So glad to have you with us on this Thursday evening. Hope you're having a great day. Lots of big stuff going on in the world today. In my household, one of the bigger deals is that Taylor Swift is dropping a new album today. Some of you don't even know who she is or the fact that she's dropping a new album. But if you've got a teenage girl in your house, you know that that is happening today. She really is amazing. The fact that while on maybe the most profitable, most amazing world tour in the history of music tours, she somehow is dropping a new album. So for those of you who can't even get your garbage out before the garbage truck comes, there are people in the world doing amazing things. So that is wild. And just a lot else going on around us. But I want to start today with what might be one of, if not the most debated things for people who go to church, for church people, for Christians, for people who are going regularly on a Sunday morning. It's not huge theological. It is important. And that is, what should we sing in church? Have you ever had that conversation with someone? As a pastor, it's come up a few times. Let's put it that way. Everybody seems to have opinions. They have less opinions about, oftentimes, the preaching, the directions. What kind of songs are we singing? How loud or not loud are they? What are the types of instruments? People really care in churches about what songs should be sung. Are we singing? And the question before us that I want us to think about is, how do you even distill the question of what should we sing? Is it just a matter of, I like that song? Or I like traditional hymns, or I like songs that I've heard on K-Love. I like, is it about our preference? How does a congregation, how does a church decide these things? You know, at my church, I play a hand in it, but we have a pastor who oversees worship. He tends to be the one that leads on Sunday mornings, and I give him a good amount of latitude towards the specific songs that we sing on any given Sunday. You know, they go along with the sermon. They go along with kind of the direction of what we're talking about and pushing on that day. But we do have conversations about what is important in a song. So that's where I want to start today. What's important in congregational singing? What makes a good congregational song? And by good, I mean worth singing, worth spending our time with as we gather together. One of the most well-known over the last decades kind of worship leader or guy speaking in this area is a guy by the name of Bob Coughlin. He's been at some of the big churches that you know, Sovereign Grace and others, written a bunch of books on worship. And he wrote over at Desiring God, and I just want to read some of what he does because I wonder if you agree. He wrote, "What should we sing? How to identify a good worship song?" He says, "I've wrestled with that question for decades, not only as a songwriter, but as a pastor in my local church. Of course, crowds sing together loudly in a variety of places, football games, Taylor Swift concerts, school choirs, birthday parties. But singing in church is unique and sacred." He says, why? "The church is the body of Christ, a temple being built together into the dwelling place for God by the Spirit. We sing so the word of Christ may dwell in us richly, as Colossians 3 says. And when we gather, our church isn't alone. Our little choir of earthly voices joins with the choirs of heaven and the assembly of the firstborn who are enrolled in heaven to extol the Lamb who was slain. So for the church, singing matters. And that's why we ask, what kind of songs should we sing? He's going to give three characteristics, with the third one, he says, being the most important as to what makes a congregational song, quote, good. Here are his three criteria. First, a good congregational song is one that people can sing. It's not hard to pick up because the melody repeats or it's easy to follow. Songs that contain unexpected twists or jumps can be confusing and will cause people to go quiet. Also, the range is important. Can people, normal people, sing these songs? So the first one is, can they sing it? The second one he says is it one that people want to sing? People comment on how much they enjoy it. The melody grows on you rather than sounding tired by the end of the song. That's why a theologically rich lyric can go unheard for decades when it's wed with the wrong melody, he says. He uses examples like Amazing Grace skyrocketing after they found a melody. So can people sing it? Do people want to sing it? And most importantly, should they sing it? That means that the lyrics matter. This is my big bugaboo when it comes to worship songs. It's not primarily about the music. It's about the lyrics. Are the lyrics rooted in God's word? But he says, does that raise some questions? Does quoting Bible verses make a good congregational song? No. Should we only sing the Psalms? No. But the lyrics matter. Do we believe that they are teaching good theology? That's what worship songs are. We're teaching theology to each other. It's like a singing of a sermon to one another. So is it speaking accurate truth? If a song contradicts what Scripture teaches in any way, no matter how fun it is to sing, we shouldn't sing it. We should reject it. But lyrics can be unbiblical in more subtle ways, right? They can be vague, unclear, easily misinterpreted. They could be confusing. It could veer off the course a little bit. We need to be careful with that. Where's the emphasis of our songs? Is it extolling Jesus? This is, again, one of my big ones. Are our songs that we are singing pointing to Jesus or pointing to us? Is it about how I feel or about who God is? Think about the songs that have most endured through time. They're about who God is, how great thou art. Amazing grace. Great is thy faithfulness. Yet so many of our songs today are about how God makes me feel. Be careful of songs with lots of I's and me's in them. That's not the point. Are they biblical? Are they sound theologically? Can people sing them? Do they want to sing them? Songs are just one part of our gatherings, but God can use them to transform lives from one degree of glory to another. And we're going to be doing this in eternity. So let's make the most of our opportunity here to sing, and sing in such a way that mirrors how it's going to be in the future. Don't go, oh, I like this song, or I heard this song that I like. It's not just about, is it catchy? Is it fun to sing? It could be fast. It could be slow. It could be loud. It could be quiet. It could be contemplative. It can be exciting. What do the lyrics say? Who are we singing about? Can I sing this song to my wife as easily as I can sing it to God? That's a problem. Let's not sing songs with watered down lyrics, but instead use the singing in our gatherings as yet another opportunity to come before the throne of God and point one another to him to say, worthy is the Lamb who was slain. Coming up next, we have to do it again. another breaking news story overnight of a well-known Christian parachurch person fired over inappropriate sexual relationship. Going to tell you that story next year on The Common Good. AM 1160, hope for your life. Welcome back to The Common Good, AM 1160, Hope for Your Life. My name is Brian Fromm. So glad to have you with us today on this Thursday afternoon. If you've missed any of our show this week, go get the podcast wherever it is. Get your podcast. Subscribe, rate, review. We're grateful for those of you who do that. You can also find us online at 1160hope.com, Facebook, Twitter, and the Instagrams at Common Good Talk. As we said, lots going on. NFL draft 1 week from today. Some of you, that could not mean less to your life. I love the NFL draft. There's a time of hope. And for the Bears kind of own the draft this year. They've got the one pick and the nine pick. I mean, that's huge. They're going to get their new quarterback and then get another good player along the way. My Giants are picking six this year. Looking forward to the NFL draft a week from today, tonight. And so that will be fun. And we continue to march on towards springtime, towards summertime, and hope that you're starting to make your plans, starting to get those things lined up and ready to go. Okay. Since day one of this show, and this, if you had asked me when we started the show, would this be a regular part of our show? I would have naively said no chance. But literally the first segment of our first show that Ian Simpkins and I did together over 5 years ago was the day that everything broke in the Chicago Tribune about Harvest Bible Chapel, James McDonald, and all of that stuff. And that led for many weeks a discussion of that. And then you had stuff at Willow Creek. We had stuff at Mars Hill. And one of the constants through our show, sadly, has been talking about leaders, pastors, parachurch organizations, major Christian kind of influencers and leaders having character ethical failures, sin that has then led to just people trying to put the pieces back together. And every time we think we're done with them, another one comes up. And I struggle with these. Sometimes you wonder, is this just gossip? Bible has strong things to say about gossip. We don't want to be gossipers. So is that what this is? But I actually think it is a necessary activity to highlight these stories in order to say, this is going on, and the follow-up, it can't. It must stop. And then another one happens, and another one happens. And yesterday, there's a great organization, to be honest with you, called Orange. If you are in the church world, you know of Orange. They have great conferences. It is all about kids ministry, youth ministry, next generation ministry. That's kind of the focus of Orange. And they have their huge conference next week in Atlanta, Georgia, with just some enormous speakers. They're going to fill an arena and try to unleash momentum, they say. Eugene Kim, Rich Viotis, amongst others, are going to be on the stage, Danielle Strickland, John Acuff, and many, many more. Well, leading up to their conference, here is what came out from their head of their board of directors. It is with profound sadness that I must share some difficult news. Both Reggie Joyner, the founder of Orange, and our CEO, Kristen Ivey, have voluntarily resigned effective immediately. Reggie has admitted to past inappropriate relationships, which violated our company policy and eroded trust within our organization. While Reggie has expressed his apologies to the entire Orange team, it's best for Reggie and Orange that he permanently steps away from the organization. During the course of the investigation, Kristen also disclosed a past inappropriate relationship with Reggie. In light of this, Kristen has chosen to resign, enabling Orange to turn the page in the next chapter. As a result, not only will they not be a part, not be part of next week's conference, but they are stepping down from the organization altogether. This board member writes kind of his thoughts a little bit. And he says, now more than ever, it's important to gather for the Orange Conference next week so we can be there for one another. If you're joining in person, you can still expect a community of leader speakers, ministry partners, and people who share unshakable hope in the future and mission of the church. Thank you for everything you do and for your ongoing support and understanding during this transitional period. That is signed by Joel Manby, it looks like is his name, the president or the board chair of Orange. So they got their huge conference next week, and their founder, Reggie Joyner, who's well known in the ministry world, they found a past inappropriate. Let me make sure you realize they said relationships, plural. One of them being with the new CEO, Kristen Ivey. And so both of them have stepped away. And this is obviously yet again shaken some people who are close to Orange. Orange is a big deal in the church world when it comes to curriculum, children's ministry, youth ministry, kind of on the leading edge of things. Reggie Joyner started the organization. Like I said, their conference, their 3-day conference next week will fill an arena. And yet we have yet another story of past inappropriate relationships. A double life, lack of character. And every time these happen, what do we say? Brothers and sisters, this has to stop. This can't be what the evangelical world is about, what those outside see. It needs to be led by men and women of high integrity, high character. I understand that there's temptation. I understand that people say sin, but the brazenness of this and the fact that he just gets added now and she to a list of people who have done this, creating a black eye for the church and the name of Jesus. Character must matter more than full arenas, than charisma, than good leadership. Character is at the core of it. And when the character, when bad character gets exposed, it comes just with terrible effects. And it reminds us of another thing when we think of conferences and arenas and leaders and movements and this and that. Thank the Lord that everything is about Jesus. We do not put our hope in fallible men and women. We do not put our hope in charismatic leaders because we don't know what they're doing behind closed doors. We don't know who they really are sometimes. We put our hope in Jesus Christ, who is the same yesterday, today, and forever. When we put our hope in people, no matter how much we think we know them, we're setting ourselves up to be let down. But when we put our hope in Jesus, he's a firm foundation. And so I hope they do gather. I hope they do sing. I hope it is a sweet time. But we are reminded again, character matters. And this is all about Jesus. It's not about the next ministry, the next charismatic leader, the next person. It's about Jesus. Well, coming up next, I'm excited to be joined by Tim Glenn from Compassion International. We're going to talk about all things Compassion International next year on The Common Good, AM 1160, Hope for Your Life. Hey friends, welcome back to The Common Good, AM 1160, Hope for Your Life. My name is Brian Fromm. So glad to have you with us on this Thursday afternoon. We said we were going to be joined by Tim Glenn from Compassion International. We had a little bit of a scheduling issue, so he's going to join us hopefully later in the week or next week. We're excited to talk to him about Compassion International. But until then, looking forward to the time we will spend with him. I hope that you're having a great day. Maybe you had a you're going home from work. I discussed yesterday how it doesn't feel like everybody, many people do the 9 to 5 anymore. But if you do do the 9 to 5, then you're almost home. And I hope that it's going well. If you're in the future listening to this show on the podcast, tell us what happens. You're in the future right now. Today for me is April 18th. Who knows what who knows what day it is for you? Anyway, glad that you're with us today. Kevin DeYoung over at Crossway. I thought this was important. It's kind of one of the things I talk about in our church often. It's called Amaze the Next Generation with God. And Kevin DeYoung, it's very short. He's just kind of talking about the next generation. And let me just read a little bit of what he says. He says, give them God, not moralism. He says, I beg of you, don't go after the next generation with mere moralism. Either on the right, don't have sex, do go to church, share your faith, stay off drugs, or on the left, recycle, dig a well, feed the homeless, buy a wristband. The gospel is a message not about what we need to do for God, but what God has done for us. Friends, that is one of the most important concepts in all of Christianity. The gospel is a message not about what we need to do for God, but about what God has done for us. So get them with the good news about who God is and what he has done. Some of us, it seems, are almost scared to tell people about God. Perhaps because we don't truly know him. Maybe because we prefer living in triviality. Or maybe because we don't consider knowing God to be very helpful in real life. I have to fight against this unbelief in my own life. If only I would trust God that he is enough to win the hearts and minds of the next generation. If it's his work much more than mine or yours. So make him front and center. Don't confuse platitudes with profundity. Don't proclaim an unknown God when we know who God is and what he is like. And don't reduce God to your own level. If ever people start starving for a God the size of God, surely it is now. Give them a God who is holy, independent, and like unlike us. A God who is good, just, full of wrath, and full of mercy. Give them a God who is sovereign, powerful, tender, and true. Give them a God with edges. Give them an undiluted God who makes them feel cherished and safe and small and uncomfortable too. Give them a God who works all things after the counsel of his will and for the glory of his name. Give them a God whose love is lavish and free. Give them a God worthy of wonder and fear, and God big enough for all our faith, hope, and love. There's more to go, but I couldn't love that more. This is about what we give to the next generation, but it's also what we need for ourselves. How big is your God? We must never lose the awe of God. A God who's so big that he's indescribable, incomprehensible, scary. But a God so loving that it is also his love and grace and closeness to us is also indescribable and incomprehensible. He loves you so much that he sent his son to die for you. And now in Christ, he calls you his child. It's not about what we can do for God or don't do. Don't do this, do this, don't do this, do this. No, it's about what God has already done for us in Jesus Christ. Such a great word. And then he says, God as the center. And he continues, do your friends, your church, your family, your children know that God is the center of the universe? Can they see that he's at the center of your life? Imagine you had a dream of someone sitting on a throne. In your dream, a rainbow encircled the throne. 24 men surrounded the throne. Lightning and thunder issued from the throne. 7 lamps stood blazing at the feet of the throne. A sea of glass lay before the throne. four strange creatures were around the throne, giving thanks to the one who sits on the throne. And the 24 dudes were falling down before the one who sits on the throne. And wouldn't have to get Joseph out of prison to figure out the point of this dream. The throne is the figurative and literal center of the vision. The meaning of the dream is God. This, of course, is no ordinary dream. It's John's vision in Revelation 4. And it is reality right now, DeYoung writes, more substantial and more lasting and more influential than your pain or fear or temptation or opposition or makeup or clothes or video games or funny clips online or edgy language or the latest tech or whatever else our culture says should be important to young people. It's God. What matters now and for eternity is the unceasing worship of him who sits on the throne. Again, awe, wonder, bigness of God. As you try to reach the next generation for Christ, you can amaze them with your cleverness, your humor, or you can amaze them with God. I need a lot of things in my life, DeYoung writes. There are schedules and details and a long to-do list. I need food and water and shelter. I need sleep. I need more exercise and I need to eat better. But this is my greatest need and yours as well, to know God, love God, delight in God, and make much of God. We have an incredible opportunity before us. Most people live weightless, ephemeral lives. We can give them substance instead of style. We can show them a big God to help make sense of their shrinking lives. We can point them to transcendence instead of triviality. We can reach them with something more lasting and more powerful than gimmicks, gadgets, and games. We can reach them with God. Imagine that. Reaching the next generation for God by showing them more of God. That's just crazy enough to work. What a powerful word there by Kevin DeYoung. I think that's great. He was writing in the context of reaching the next generation. But friends, if we're going to have a faith that lasts, this is the vision of God that we need. One of transcendence, one of awe, and one of wonder. We look to God as the author of all life, the creator of all of creation, yet the one who has stooped down to save us because he loves us. Give the next generation and give yourself a big picture of God. And everything else will fall into place under it. Such a good word there, I believe, from Kevin DeYoung. Coming up next, we're going to go a little more trivial. I want to talk about the selfie generation, the selfie world that we live in, with just a crazy story out of North Carolina. What some people did to get what they thought would be a great selfie. We're going to do that next year on The Common Good. AIM 1160, hope for your life. Welcome back to The Common Good, AIM 1160, Hope for Your Life. My name is Brian Fromm. So glad to have you with us on this Thursday afternoon. If you've missed any of the show, I'd encourage you to go get the podcast wherever it is you get your podcast. Just subscribe, rate, review. You can also find us online at 1160hope.com, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Common Good Talk. It's allergy season, right? Like, I'm kind of hurting right now. I don't tend to have bad allergies all the year, but this time of year when things are blooming and this, that, man, it goes nuts. My eyes itch, my throat gets scratchy. And I've heard from a lot of you, talked to a lot of friends who are feeling the same way right now. It's like allergies are kicking in. I always find like allergies are, there are certain things that are, they point us to the fallenness of this world, isn't it? Like, I'm pretty confident there will not be allergies in heaven. that there's not going to be, I'm not going to get to heaven and just be have sneezing attacks or have itchy eyes because of allergies. What else falls under that category? Like, we always talk about the big things, sin and death and brokenness that won't be a part of heaven, but like, will mosquitoes be there? I don't think so. I can't imagine mosquitoes, mold, allergies, traffic. Are these things going to be there? Or is this just a sign of the brokenness of this world? I know allergies not going to be there. No way, because nobody enjoys allergies. Nobody goes, you know what this world needs more of? It's allergies. So those of you who are sneezing, those of you who have scratchy throats and itchy eyes, we're there with you. And hopefully it will calm itself down soon. Okay. Speaking of the fallenness of this world, every now and then you read an article that goes, what is wrong with us as people? One of the scourges of our society, one of the things that is just so annoying is how much people want to take selfies and pictures with things. Have you ever been to a concert or a sporting event and somebody is just filming it and filming it and filming it, and you're like, just enjoy it. Just enjoy. One of the amazing things about the Masters golf tournament that just happened, and that people notice when they're there and when they're watching on TV, is people aren't allowed to bring their phones on the grounds. And so nobody's taking pictures. Nobody's shooting video. Nobody's taking selfies. People are just in the moment. But it's not just being in the moment. It's the dumb things people do in order to take selfies. Sometime, Google stories of people who have fallen to their death on mountains or Grand Canyon or over a cliff because they were taking a selfie. You'll be reading for a while. People do dumb things. And with that in mind, let me give you yet another exhibit in our trial of how dumb are we as a selfie culture. We're shaking your head going, what is your problem? I'm reading from the New York Post a story out of North Carolina. The headline just says this: group snatches bear cubs out of tree just to take selfies with them in disturbing clip. An unsettling video shows a group of people carelessly ripping bear cubs out of a tree to snap some selfies in North Carolina. The group of about six people was caught on video Tuesday pulling three scared black bear cubs out of a tree over a fence at an apartment complex. During the video, several individuals were seen posing with the cubs, with one person even dropping one while holding it. Another cub was seen frantically running away from the group, trying to get back over the fence. Police were called and enlisted the help of the North Carolina Wildlife Resources Commission special projects people. That person said she saw the video of the three cubs, but only one remained when she got on the scene. We did follow up with the people who pulled the bear out of the tree. We did confront them on site that day and let them know how irresponsible and potentially deadly it could be for that cub to be separated from its mom, especially ripped out of a tree like that. The wildlife specialist said it was uncommon for a mother bear to leave her cubs unattended in a tree at this time of year, but that seems to be what happened. She suspects that the cubs have been left alone for a long time, with the cub being on its own for an unknown amount of time and having humans take it from safety. The ordeal left the little critter shaken. We do think that the bear probably had a very traumatic experience. Now, the good news is they took him to an animal rehab facility, and they will be released back in the wild. So no serious damage was done. But here's the quote: it's frustrating to see that people that irresponsible around wildlife, because it's a blessing that we get to live in the mountains around these creatures. Though it's rare to see blatant disregard for wildlife, she said she hopes this can be an educational experience for those involved. Jody Williams, founder of Help Asheville Bears, saw the video and was shaken. She said, all for a selfie, all for a selfie. It's just ignorance, total selfishness. It's not what we talk about when we talk about coexisting. All right, let's just unpack this. First of all, to think that that this is a good idea. You come out of your apartment and you see bear cubs and you're like, you know what I'm going to do? I want to take a selfie holding a bear cub. Is lunacy. The biggest reason is because if you have any brain on you, you know that bear cubs usually come with a bear mom. And bear moms do not act well when their bear cubs have been taken. Now, that's not the case in this one, but they're lucky. But two, who looks up and sees bear cubs and goes, you know what? I'm going to hold them and take a selfie. It makes no logical sense. It makes no sense. Friends, if you're a selfie person, don't get me wrong. My family, we take selfies. We like to do things, you know, when you're out and about to memorialize something you're doing, to remember what you're doing. But the things people do to get the quote unquote best selfie these days is ridiculous. It's craziness. And this is yet another example of it. Selfies, by definition, are selfish. Don't be the person that disturbs other people. And certainly don't be the person that endangers yourself or other people or animals or whatever else it might be for getting that shot. Grabbing little baby bear cubs out of a tree to take selfies. And there's a group of people gathered around like they all thought this was a good idea. This is craziness. You're just thankful nobody got hurt, including the bear cubs. Well, coming up next, how do I share the gospel to people who've heard it all before? I want to talk a little bit about evangelism. Next year on The Common Good, AM 1160, Hope for Your Life. What does good evangelism look like? And then, is truth a distraction? You're listening to The Common Good. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to The Common Good here on AM 1160, Hope for Your Life. My name is Brian Fromm. So glad to have you with us today on this Thursday afternoon. If you've missed any of the show, go get the podcast wherever it is. Get your podcast. Subscribe, rate, and review. You can also find us online at 1160hope.com. Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Common Good Talk. I know we have a lot of pastors who listen to the show. If that's where you're at, I hope sermon prep is going great for the week. Or if you're like me, I hope sermon prep does go great later in the week once you really dive into it. It is hard to get to. It can be difficult, but such an important part of our role. Also an important part of the role for all of us as Christians is evangelism. We learn, Paul writes, do the work of an evangelist. Some of us are gifted. Myself, I'm not. But some of us are wired and gifted to evangelize. Have you ever been around that person who's just good at bringing up things of Jesus, good at being bold and talking to people? They just have that as part of who they are. But for most of us, it's a scary thing. And then it's the thing we tend to avoid. Evangelism. If you've been around the show, you know I've shared this story before, but when I was summer after my sophomore year of high school, we went to a youth kind of week, not camp, but kind of a week called Operation Good News down on the Jersey Shore. I grew up in New Jersey. It was down by Long Beach Island, and it was all about evangelism. I grew up in the Christian Missionary Alliance. This was a CMA thing. And you went there, and in the morning, it was kind of like a classroom setting. They taught you evangelism techniques. They taught you how to evangelize. And then in the afternoon, you would load up in vans, and they would drop you off in twos. You might have gotten dropped off at the beach. You might have gotten dropped off at a mall. You might have gotten dropped off wherever. And then in the evening, you came back, and you shared your stories of how it went. How many people prayed the prayer? It was a fun week because of the stuff we, other stuff we got to do, going to the beach and stuff like that. It was not a fun week because it was terrifying to do that. And I've often said that that week actually hurt my desire to evangelize because I began to associate evangelism with fear. Again, there are people who love doing it this way and they're good at it. I'm not like, I'm not wired this way. So one day me and this girl got dropped off at Atlantic City of all places. People aren't going to Atlantic City to have theological conversations. But her and I, as just two kind of scared high school kids, walked up to people with clipboards. Can I ask you a few questions? If you were to die today, do you know where you're going? And people are like, I just want to go to the beach. I just want to go to the casino. And again, nothing wrong with the method, but it was being taught as this is the method. And the end goal was just to get people to pray the prayer. And I remember feeling to myself, like, I feel like I'm being intrusive of these people. Like, is this really the only way to do it? The other end of the spectrum is the whole concept of friendship evangelism, right? I make friends, I connect with people, and over time I share my story, which is great. And I shared the story of Jesus, which is great, except that a lot of us never get to the point of sharing Jesus. So what does good evangelism look like? I don't think there's a method. I don't think it's even about the method as much as about the principles behind it. Relevant Magazine asked, how do I share the gospel, particularly to people who've heard it all before? They say, obviously, comfort shouldn't be the deciding factor for whether we evangelize. And Jesus instructed us to carry out the Great Commission, regardless of whether it's easy or difficult. But our entire concept of evangelism needs to change. Here are five principles Christians should apply when evangelizing. So whatever your methodology, here's five principles to think about. First, make it about God. Make it about God. Evangelism isn't about promoting yourself, a pastor, a church, or a denomination. It's not even about heaven or hell. Instead, it's ultimately about a relationship with Jesus, about revealing God. So if your evangelism is only about, hey, go to the good place, not the hot place down there, it's about heaven and hell and fire insurance, that's not focused on the right thing. Make it about Jesus. Help people get a grasp for who Jesus is, how good he is. Make it about him. Secondly, they write, be motivated out of love. Too often, evangelism is driven by hate, distrust, guilt, shame, bitterness, and fear. It shouldn't be about stats, fulfilling a quota, self-righteously patting yourself on the back, or reinforcing your own beliefs. If evangelism isn't motivated by love, just stop doing it. Just stop doing it. Be motivated out of love. That was what was missing at that conference I was just telling you about. That was motivated by statistics. Feel good about yourself, getting them to pray the prayer. Number three, be honest. We mistakenly assume our faith testimony should be rehearsed without error and perfectly tidy, but this isn't the messy reality of life. They write, honestly, we don't have all the answers, and our faith isn't about knowing everything. Instead, it's about knowing God. So above everything else, they write, be real, be honest, be questioning, allow questions, process. Number four, be graceful. The gospel isn't about proving others wrong. It's about sharing the love of Christ. Evangelism should be full of patience, empathy, dialogue, mutual appreciation, full of grace and understanding. Learn, listen, and never approach someone with an attitude of moral superiority. Always be humble. be graceful. And lastly, they say, be respectful. Evangelism isn't hijacking a family while they're walking to a baseball game or yelling at a bus full of helpless passengers. Sometimes we need to learn to tone it down and prayerfully wait for the right opportunity to come along. We mistakenly assume evangelism should consist of high pressure tactics, right? It's like trying to sell. For some of us, we think of it as like those high pressure vacation home rental things where they just sit you down and you're like this timeshare deals like buy, 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 buy. But it's opposite. Think about you're more comfortable talking with people like in a normal way. Evangelism should feel normal. For Christians, when we ask what should modern evangelism look like, ultimately the answer is Jesus. It's dedicating our lives to helping those in need. So in action, right? Feeding the poor, taking care of the sick, and all of these things. And then being with people who are hurting. Jesus says, I came for the sick. So emulate the life of Jesus. Preach the gospel in word and deed. Pray that God would open up those opportunities. And then step into them and do the work of an evangelist. Well, coming up next, NPR CEO Catherine Maher had some wild stuff to say about truth. I want you to listen to this and then talk about it next year on The Common Good. AM 1160, hope for your life. Welcome back to The Common Good. AM 1160, hope for your life. My name is Brian Fromm. So glad to have you with us again on this Thursday afternoon as we continue to try to figure out what does it mean to follow Jesus in this world that we live in. That's the point of the Common Good. That's the point of this show. It's always been the point of this show to take our faith, the ways of Jesus, the teachings of Jesus, the callings of Jesus, and try to then place them upon the issues of the day, the struggles of our life. How do we live out this faith, not just on Sunday, but really Monday through Saturday? Like, I remember when we were trying to name this show years and years ago, one of the options that we batted around before coming up with The Common Good was Between Sundays, with the idea that we know what it looks like to be a Christian on Sunday. But what's it look like to be a Christian on Monday and Tuesday and Wednesday and the rest of our week in our jobs, in our homes, doing the things that we do, going about our day? How do we follow Jesus in those times? And so hopefully you get, we serve a little bit of help for you as we do that. Part of the Christian experience, part of the Christian conversation, part of what we talk about in the church and within our greater culture is the idea of truth. Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. Nobody gets to the Father except through me. All the way back in Jesus's time, there was this disagreement about truth. When Jesus is on trial, when Jesus is before Pontius Pilate and proclaims to be the truth, what does Pontius Pilate say? What is truth? What is truth? I always picture him saying it in that way. What is truth? And certainly in our culture, we constantly speak of my truth, your truth. And how do we proceed as Christians in a culture that says there is no standard truth? There is no concept of truth. There is no anchoring of truth. There's just what you think is true and what I think is true. That's the question. Is there anything out there that's objectively true, or is all truth subjective? NPR CEO Catherine Maher, she used to be at Wikipedia. You're going to hear her mention Wikipedia here, which makes this interesting. Because if you know anything about Wikipedia, there's no real standard of what's being written in there is actually true. And that gets weird and dangerous at times with Wikipedia. It's why the joke is when kids are like, oh, I wrote my paper from Wikipedia. You're like, oh, I don't know about that. So this clip is from a few years ago, I believe, but she's giving a TED talk and she speaks about truth. I want to play about 2 minutes of it. Okay. Hone in, listen, because I think her message about truth is the cultural message. Let's listen to NPR CEO Catherine Maher. Okay. Our reverence for the truth might be a distraction that's getting in the way of finding common ground and getting things done. She kind of goes back and forth saying, now I'm not saying there's not things that are true, but then now we get into the cultural element of there are things that are true to you, but your truth might be different than my truth. My truth might be different than the truth of the person sitting next to me. And so we are respective of each other's truths. And we don't allow our reverence for the truth to become a distraction to what she thinks are the more important things. Common ground, getting things done. Here's a question, friends. Is she right? Is the most that we can talk about when it comes to truth, my truth, your truth, is it subjective in that way? Because when we open up the Gospels, it certainly does not appear that Jesus speaks of the truth subjectively. He doesn't say, I am a truth. He doesn't say, I am your truth or my truth. Jesus says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. The Bible speaks of Jesus Christ as the truth. You know, some religions speak of Jesus as a way. Jesus says, I am the way. And if we're not careful within the church, we can very quickly begin to believe that Jesus is an option. There's nothing. You believe what you want to believe. I believe what I want to believe. The only important thing is that we are tolerant of each other. See, we don't fully believe this because there are things that we have as a society have said, this is right and this is wrong. Right? There are certain norms and laws that you cannot break and say, well, my truth says that's okay. We don't do that. But when it comes to belief systems, when it comes to how we view the world, when it comes to how we view God, people really bristle at this is what is true and this is what is not. Yet Christianity claims this is true for all people. So what do you believe? Do you hold that bit of historical Christian orthodox? It will run you against the flow of culture. But without it, the power of the gospel kind of softens, goes away. What do you believe about this concept of truth? What Catherine Maher said here is kind of the way that many people believe. But I would suggest that this can't be the message of the church. Coming up next, a final Jeopardy question about the Bible left some fans outraged. We're going to talk about that next year on The Common Good, AM 1160, Hope for Your Life. Back to The Common Good here on AIM 1160, Hope for Your Life. My name is Brian Fromm. So glad to have you with us today on this Thursday afternoon. Go back, get the show if you've missed it. We've talked a lot about a lot of good things today, including a sign of the fallenness of this world being allergies. Even between segments here, just sneezing and man, it's that time of year. But hey, springtime, we're going to get to see beautiful things outside. Things will be in full bloom here soon. So anyway, we're glad that you're joining us, even if you're doing so sneezing. All right, Jeopardy. Are you a fan of Jeopardy? I think I don't ever watch Jeopardy, but with that said, I think Jeopardy is probably my favorite game show, like the regular game shows, right? Like we go through phases of game shows, but I'm talking like one that's been on for a long time. No, I shouldn't say Jeopardy's my favorite. I'd go number one, Price is Right. I'd probably go Price is Right, especially back in the Bob Barker days, but even now with the Drew Carey days, I enjoy good Price is Right. When the Price is Right music comes on, you feel as if you're home from school. Like that's what you feel like when the Price is Right music comes on. When you made it, when you were home from school sick and Bob Barker came on, it was like, oh, I'm not going to school today. I'm home. I'm going to lay here on the couch with a blanket on and watch Bob Barker and the Price is Right. That was always it. That was it. Summertime, you know, summer vacation, you heard Bob Barker. But Jeopardy, especially with Alex Trebek, that was for the smart people. Oftentimes, Wheel of Fortune was on right before Jeopardy. Wheel of Fortune was for us dumber people. Jeopardy was for the really smart people. And so you'd watch Jeopardy, and anything you got right, you felt like your IQ went up, right? You get a Jeopardy question right, my IQ goes up. What always amazes me about Jeopardy is oftentimes how bad the contestants are when it comes to sports questions. I get it. Like not everybody knows sports, but it feels like in general, these Jeopardy contestants know something about everything. And then the sports question comes on and it will ask, you know, some this running back for the Chicago Bears in the 19, like the most obvious question, and nobody will know it's Walter Payton. Just kind of stare at each other. It always amazes me. And it always seemed like it made Alex Trebek angry that nobody knew the answers to those questions. Why am I bringing up Jeopardy? Well, there was a Jeopardy question the other recently, I believe, that left some people outraged and feeling like it was unfair. And it was about the Bible. Controversy ensued after a contentious final Jeopardy clue, I'm reading. Former champions Andrew He, Amy Schneider, and Sam Buttrey faced off in Wednesday's game for Jeopardy's Tournament of Champions, which pits former champions against one another. The first to win three rounds wins the championship. During Final Jeopardy, host Ken Jennings asked the contestants this question. Paul's letter to them is the New Testament epistle with the most Old Testament quotations. I butchered that a little bit. Let me read that again. Paul's letter to them is the New Testament epistle with the most Old Testament questions. Quotations. Jeez, reading. Reading's a skill here, folks. He, most likely referring to Philippians, wrote Philippians, which was declared the wrong answer, as was Buttrey's answer of Romans. Schneider wrote, who are the Hebrews, which Jennings stated to be the correct answer. So what was the problem? With Buttrey's wrong answer, he won the round. That was the guy's last name, won the round, putting him one away from the ultimate victory. Here's where the controversy was, because as one theologian wrote on Twitter, the challenge, Hebrews has the most Old Testament quotes of any New Testament letter. It was historically attributed to Paul, but today most argue he didn't write it based mainly on internal evidence. Had the book of Romans been deemed correct, so here's the deal. If it's not Hebrews, then Romans is the answer. And had the book of Romans been deemed correct, fan favorite Buttrey would have won the round over He. Other historians and theologians chimed in with their agreement on social media and shared sources. What's the background? You might not know that. Have you ever noticed your pastor will probably say the author to the Hebrews? It's because of all the books of the New Testament, there is disagreement about who wrote Hebrews. And although Hebrews has been historically attributed to Paul, several factors have led Bible scholars to believe the book was written by someone else. One reason for this is that the writer of Hebrews states in Hebrews 2:3 that he received the gospel through an apostle. this contradicts more Pauline type of stuff, like 1 Corinthians and Galatians, where Paul states he received the gospel directly from Jesus. Also, despite the book of Hebrews being filled with Old Testament quotes, the quotes are taken from the Septuagint, which is a Greek translation. In other letters attributed to Paul, he always quotes the Masoretic text, which is written in the original Hebrew, or he paraphrases it. There's also the lack of the normal Paul greeting to the letter. So despite some inconsistencies, Clement of Alexandria suggested that perhaps Paul wrote the letter originally, but Luke later translated it. Eusebius referred to Clement's belief in the church history writing, saying, Clement says that the epistle to the Hebrews is the work of Paul and that it was written to the Hebrews in the Hebrew language, but that Luke translated it carefully and published it for the Greeks, and hence the same style of expression is found in Hebrews and in Acts. Others believe it's more likely that someone like Barnabas, who was a Levite and would have had interest in the Levitical priesthood the book refers to, wrote the letter. So whoever wrote the epistle, Paul, having written the book of Hebrews, is far from universally established. As Thomas Schreiner wrote in Lexham Press, all the theories are guesses, which some are fascinating and alluring to be sure. We don't really know who wrote Hebrews. No theory of authorship has won the day, and for good reason, for the answer to our quest lies outside the domain of historical knowledge. Origen's words about the author still ring true today. This is what Origen wrote about the author of Hebrews. God only knows. So, what should have happened? What should have happened in Final Jeopardy? If the answer is Hebrews, one guy wins. If the answer is Romans, the other guy wins. They declared it to be the book of Hebrews. I've always learned that we don't know who wrote the book of Hebrews. It might have been Paul. It might have been others. But Jeopardy weighing in on the theological debate going, Paul, it's Paul. Fascinating. Jeopardy, did you get it wrong? Did you get it right? Come on, Ken Jennings. Acknowledge the theological disagreement around the authorship of the Hebrews. Next time your pastor is preaching out of Hebrews, see how he or she says it. Do they say the author to the Hebrews? Paul? How do they? I always say the author to the Hebrews. Just, we don't know. We don't know. Coming up next, we're going to close the show with a tweet of encouragement from Pastor Dr. Derwin Gray. We're going to do that next year on The Common Good. AM 1160. Hope for your life. Welcome back to The Common Good here on AM 1160, Hope for Your Life. My name is Brian Fromm. So glad to have you with us as we close out this Thursday afternoon. If you've missed any of today's show, go get the podcast wherever it is you get your podcast. Just subscribe, rate, review. You can also find us online at 1160hope.com, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Common Good Talk. Well, we're glad that you are joining us today. As we close out today's show, we do so with just some encouragement, I just want you to feel good. I want you to be encouraged, but encouraged specifically through God's word. Pastor Derwin Gray, pastor of Transformation Church, we've had him on the show before. But you also might remember Derwin Gray is the pastor who was an NFL safety. So Derwin Gray writes this. In a world that seems to be spinning out of control, remember the sovereignty and unfailing love of our God. In a world that seems to be spinning out of control, remember the sovereignty and unfailing love of our God. Ephesians chapter 1, verse 10. He quotes it from the NLT. And this is the plan. At the right time, he will bring everything together under the authority of Christ. Everything in heaven and on earth. And this is the plan. At the right time, he will bring everything together under the authority of Christ. Everything in heaven and on earth. let's take the first part of his quote. Does everything seem like it is spinning out of control? In a world that seems to be spinning out of control. Right? It does feel that way, doesn't it? It does feel like the world is spinning out of control. Like we look at the wars going on. What's going on in Israel right now? You could get scared. Oh, man, I don't know about this. I just don't know what to think about this. The Ukraine, inflation, rising gas prices, or at least not lowering gas prices, a contentious election, not to mention what's going on in your own life. Maybe it's a health issue, a financial issue. So yeah, there's lots of good going on in the world, lots of good going on in our lives, but there are times where things feel really unstable and the things feel really out of control. What's going on in your life right now that is making it feel out of control? In a world that seems to be spinning out of control, we remember the sovereignty and unfailing love of our God. We remember the sovereignty. God is in control. God knows what's going on. He knows what's going on in the world. He didn't wake up one day and go, wait, what happened? Israel and Iran, what? God's sovereign. He knows what's going on. He's not surprised. And we also remember his unfailing love, that God is good. God is present. He says, I'm near to the brokenhearted, that when things are spinning out of control, we can trust that they're not spinning out of control for God, but that he knows what's going on and that ultimately he is victorious, that ultimately there is coming a day. Ultimately, there's coming a day where the spinning out of control of this world will be no more. Ultimately, there is coming a day where we will sit before the throne of our Lord, our Messiah, our Savior, and there will be no more tears, there will be no more pain, there will be no more cancer, there will be no more inflation, there will be no more struggle, there will be no more broken relationships, there will be no more death. And we can hold on. That can cause us to go, okay, things feel rocky now. Things feel out of control now. But thanks be to God, it will not always be this way. God promises, I will be present with you now, and I am victorious both now and forever. So we push on. We keep going. Like, that's good news, friends. That's not some pie in the sky pretend thing. That is reality. And so we push on and we keep going. Does your world feel like it's spinning out of control right now? Why? What is causing that? Does it feel like it's spinning out of control? And if it does feel like it's spinning out of control, what role does God play? What role does your faith play in anchoring you? So I love the picture of the firm foundation of the anchoring. God is still in control, even when things seem out of control. That's his sovereignty. God is still present and active. That's his unfailing love for us. God is still victorious through the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ. That's the good news. Ephesians 1, and this is the plan. At the right time, in his time, God will bring everything together under the authority of Jesus Christ. Everything in heaven and on earth. Friends, there's coming a day at the right time. He will. Not he might, not he hopes to. He will. There is coming a day. It's a day of victory when it no longer will feel like the world is spinning out of control. remember the sovereignty and the unfailing love of our God, especially when things seem crazy. At the right time, in His perfect timing, at the right time, God will, that's a promise, God will bring everything together under the authority of Jesus Christ. There's coming a day when there will be no more pain, there will be no more tears, there will be no more death or cancer or any of this. The world will not feel like it's spinning out of control, but there will be shalom, there will be peace, there will be tranquility under the lordship of our Lord Jesus Christ. And that, my friends, is good news. Well, if you missed any of today's show, go check out the podcast, wherever it is you get your podcast. And join us tomorrow from 4 until 6 as we close out the week. I hope you have a great night. My name is Brian Fromm, and you've been listening to The Common Good on AM 1160. Hope for your life.
General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.